the casualties, so to speak, of this burden of anxiety. Another way we know this is from writers like Morton Hunt, who made a study of extramarital affairs and done interviews with people, and it comes out very clearly. All the extra problems in their lives that are created because of the burden of anxiety and guilt. Ira Reese has done a study, I think it was Ira Reese, where he found that a very large proportion of young people who'd indulge in sexual activity had felt guilty at some time or other about what they were doing. Okay, but all that is, well, this is all one plane. Now let's look at it another plane. There is a considerable amount of recognition in psychoanalytic psychiatric theory, besides what I quoted Leighton earlier, about the importance of sexual fulfillment for emotional well-being. And this is one of those components along with work, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Kinsey studies done about 1950 found that 3/4 of the men he surveyed regularly ejaculated within 2 minutes of penetration. In other words, at some point, you know, in lovemaking, a certain amount of foreplay, penetration, within 2 minutes later, the man ejaculated. Now, he felt that this was not a problem because this indicates, in a sense, a kind of biological superiority. The faster you are at running, the faster you are at, you know, with all responses, the faster you are with sexual response. Unfortunately, most men don't view it with the same kind of comfort, nor do their wives, because very few women are able to come to orgasm in 2 minutes of penetration. And there is a considerable amount of feeling that an orgasm in intercourse is more fulfilling. Not all the time, but at least it's something that one doesn't want to miss out on entirely. So there's a suggestion from this that 3/4 of men of relationships are not sexually functional in the full sense. And that's not even a very full sense. Kinsey studies also found, and this data is a little old, unfortunately, that with women born between the years of 1920 and 29, it gets worse as you go back in time. That's the most recent data he gave. 1920, they would be about 50 now, but at the time of the study, they were in their 30s. 1 out of 5 women during their first year of marriage, never reached orgasm from any source, including masturbation. And 1 out of 10 reached orgasm only 1/3 of the time in coitus, not necessarily with penetration, but I mean, in any part of the lovemaking experience. I don't know if that percentage has gone down or not. I haven't found any statistical data. Masters and Johnson, who I think based their estimate on clinical judgments by them, their own experience and many other therapists, marriage counselors, etc., feel that as a conservative estimate, 1/2 of all marriages in this country are either sexually dysfunctional now or imminently so in the future. Now this is, we get concerned about a disease when it affects maybe 10% of the population. He's saying that this is affecting 50% of the population. This is overwhelming, and yet there aren't any public health programs, to the best of my knowledge, that are dealing with the question of sexual dysfunction. Yet we find it's certainly one of the factors, a principal factor in divorce, and the divorce rate is testimony to how, I mean, if we lack other evidence, that's one indication of just how widespread this is. What is maybe even more important, or certainly at least as important, is the effect that sexual dysfunction has on the relationship. Typically, according to sex therapists, what one finds is that when the sexual communication folds up, maybe even because of this impotence suggestion that I made before, or premature ejaculation, or the wife's not having orgasm and getting frustrated, what happens is that there is a gradual closing down in communication in all respects between the couple. They talk to each other less. They show affection for each other less because of the, after all, there's a sign of, well, there's the frustration maybe if things start going too far. In a way, it's a painful reminder of where things aren't going. They watch television more. They draw apart from each other. And there's a real barrier that builds up so that not only have they lost sexual pleasure, but they've lost many of the other pleasures that came from their marriage. And I guess if you all go to hear John Castle, or if you were in Epi 160, you know that there is growing evidence that intimate relationships are an important method by which we avoid our susceptibility to all sorts of emotional and physical difficulties, like, say, even tuberculosis, upper respiratory infections of other kinds. And so here we have a situation where sexual non-communication is breaking apart relationships. Well, I'd like to go on because I've got things about, you know, this, it affects relationship between unmarried people, adolescents and parent-child relationships, and all sorts of things. But I see that it's getting kind of late, and I did want to have a chance for us to talk more openly. So let me just conclude with what I think a public health approach to sexuality would be. When you've got something like malaria epidemic in a country, and you go there as the public health worker, you don't try to get all the people who've got malaria in to see the doctor. First of all, you don't have doctors. Secondly, while you're getting them, the disease is being transmitted to other people. It's one approach, but it's only one. The public health approach, I had a little card which spelled it out nicely, but I lost it. Here it is. Well, the first thing you do is you do research into the causes of the disease, how it's transmitted, how you might cure it, how you might develop a vaccine. The second thing you do is you educate people about the disease. You tell them what measures they could take to avoid infection. Then maybe you develop a vaccine, or in some other way you pursue environmental modification to eliminate the sources of infection. You dry up the swamps, you pass out mosquito netting, etc. Okay, now, in sexuality, I think we really are faced with a similar kind of problem because it's contagious and because of the proportions that it's on. We don't have sex therapists now for half of all married couples. We don't even have them for 10%. And that's not counting the unmarried couples. To try to develop those, to try to train all these therapists would be ineffective. It's just much too much of a job, and it's not even clear that that would solve the whole problem. What we have to do is, one, when you go to see a therapist because of a sex problem, one of the things you get is encouragement. You get sex education. They tell you, look, this is natural. You shouldn't be anxious. You needn't be anxious because you got sexually aroused when you were nursing your infant. That's perfectly natural. Don't feel bad if you're getting sexual feelings for people that you're not married to. That's perfectly natural. Anxiety reduction. A second thing is support. Sexual pleasure is important for you. It's a valid part of life. You owe it to yourself. Go ahead. Encouragement. And permission. What Masters and Johnson say is that in their sex therapy, one basic element is they give the couple permission to enjoy sex. And this is a common theme that runs through sex therapy and by other teams. Now, what we ought to do, it seems to me, the public health approach, is to take these things and put them in the open. Instead of taking the person who comes in guilt-ridden, anxiety-ridden, and dysfunctional and say, oh, sex isn't that bad, enjoy it, it's okay, we ought to be able to say out in the open, look, first of all, here are the facts about sex. Don't get worried about masturbating. You don't have to be worried about losing your potency later because of et cetera, et cetera. Secondly, to encourage, sexual pleasure is a legitimate part of life. Everyone has a right to it. It's natural for you to feel bad if you're sexually frustrated or lonely. Give permission. And secondly, another function of this is to tell people how to avoid infection. Say, look, one of the reasons that you feel anxious and guilty is because you were brought up that way. Fine, okay, that's where you're at. Not much we can do about that right now. But another reason is that you're constantly receiving negative reinforcement from people. The fact that sexuality is supposed to be extremely private. If you have a great orgasm last night, you want to come in and say, wow, you know, I had this great orgasm last night. It was just fantastic. You know, people are going to look at you, you know, wow. If you listen to a great TV program or lost 10 pounds or ran a mile, you know, we like to tell people about our good experiences and we like to tell them about our bad ones. This is a natural part of relating to people. Alexander Layton's point about the need, the striving to belong to a feel of belonging to a moral order, a feeling right in what one does. If you can't tell people and communicate openly about your experiences, you can't help but feel a little uptight about that. And I think to explain to people that this is how it is, and that a lot of their bad feelings come from the input they're receiving from society, gives them a bit more of a way to cope with negative input. It helps them to feel right about themselves in an environment which is not supportive as it might be. And then all these things have to go on simultaneously, but one of the most important things is the question of institutional change. Because one of this split-level approach to sexuality that we have in mental health is that in counseling situations or therapy, in theory, we say sex is legitimate, it's important for satisfaction, da 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 da. In our practice, we do very, very, very little to demonstrate this. For example, with college students, we put them in separate dormitories. We warn them we don't want to let them together at all. In high school, we don't let them boys and girls get together. We don't provide contraceptive information, except in the context this is to prevent your getting in trouble and pregnant. We, you know, basically the environment is very, the institutional environment is very non-supportive. We don't provide ways for people to get to know each other easily. For older people, put them in institutions and don't give them a chance to have any kind of a sexual life. So that we really have to change the institutional environment if we're going to create sexual health and relationship health. And I went on pretty long. I said a lot. But I'm going to stop here now, so maybe we can at least deal with some questions or something.
We have a class in here at 2.
At 2? A class in here? Okay.
I yeah. think there's only one thing I think it's really good, a well-reasoned and really good rap, you know. But the one thing that I think is missing is the also permission to abstain, the choice to abstain and still be part of your moral order that you're talking about. And that's the thing, you know, that I find rather dangerous about what you put up on the board, for example. And, you know, we don't want to go the other way. And one could even think that if you think of the historical, like Western civilization have kind of cycles in how rigid or punitive or sex control things are, you can almost see reactions to this and that, and perhaps in less punitive, less rigid times, there have been people so uncomfortable with that because of being out of a feeling of being out of the moral order that, you know, a struggle that's really ensued that's produced a swing the other way.
Mm-hmm. I think to also take that natural thing, you stressed a lot, and you stressed it there the whole way through about things being natural. And yet, and you're advocating a lot of sex. And then you, in order to follow that up, you have to advocate birth control. No birth control is natural, therefore it's more natural to abstain from sex rather than adopting unnatural means of birth control. So I think the emphasis on natural in kind. This is going to be followed through.
By forbidding birth control?
Not forbidding. No. I mean, you might forbid it for yourself. You might say, I want to abstain from sex during this time of the month. And that's a natural choice based more on nature than the fact that you want to have sex and you have to use unnatural means to prevent conception.
Did you? I mean?
How did you see it? Culturally validation of this is what you've been talking about. And my country, Korea, suggests people just suppress, you know, their sexual and intersexual life because they have been grown up in such a circumstance. So there's no such, you know, sex, causal, you know, or social problem, emotional problem. I've never
heard. Never?
I mean, you know, the divorce or any kinds of, you know, anxiety or guilt came from the sexual maladjustment or sexual dissatisfaction. Because the people, when the couple is grown up, and they kind of, you know, suppressed the feeling. I mean, sex should not be, you know, satisfied by woman. That's why she never complained about, you know, emotional problem is related to, you know, sexual or dissatisfaction. So what I'm talking about is this country, sexual standard, the standard of sexuality is quite different from the life you grew up. And I've been to Taiwan, Japan, and Korea, and I'm talking about a lot of people about this kind of thing. But they say that we are completely different from the American society. So, but that's what I just comment that question. But my big question is, how country validation you've been talking about this kind of thing, particularly in terms of the sex education.
You're saying that, are you asking, like, for example, do these concepts apply in another culture?
No, I can't, right? I said I cannot apply.
You cannot apply them.
Mm-hmm. He said, anxiety deduction, even permission. So all those things I can't possibly do in my country.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that I'm French educator, I've tried to introduce kind of sexual education when I've been learning here. But when I wrote my letter about this thing, my government asked me, don't stop learning that kind of thing. Ridiculous. That's why we have to build into our own sexual education
program.
Mm-hmm. It's completely different.
Do you think in the situation you brought the term mental health in here, that a country such as Korea with the culture as such as it is reinforcing this, you would have less mental problems in a situation like we have where we don't know whether we're fish or fowl, they know where they stand. And over here you don't know, just like it was brought up the gal here. You don't know which way to go. You know, you don't know what's right and what's wrong, whereas they know exactly what's right and what's wrong in their mind. So it's, you know, to me they're in a much better position. Well, the person agrees or disagrees with them, they know where they stand.
Well,
the area of uncertainty as to whether, you know, it's right or it's wrong, and either one you do, you're going to have part of you is going to say, well, this is wrong, regardless of which way you go.
Right.
Whereas he doesn't.
Well, yeah. See, one of the things is that it's the disintegration or inconsistency in a culture from transition that generates a lot of the problems that we see. But what we're faced with in the future, developmentally, is that we're going to have to limit population, which means that women are not going to be able to devote themselves totally or overwhelmingly to bringing up a family. They're going to get involved more in working. They're going to get involved more with getting education.
You pose that as an either-or thing. I reject that. But go ahead. I mean,
okay, well, let me develop it.
Silence isn't accepting them.
Okay. There are reasons why America used to be much more, as you described, Korea. But the changes have taken place here, I think will be taking place in the rest of the world, in different ways maybe, but women are not going to be in the place that they've been for many years, and they're going to be demanding sexual satisfaction when they learn more about it. So that while they may not be frustrated now because they don't know what's possible, I don't know if you'll be able to keep them in ignorance for too many more decades. So it may be that you're just seeing the problems you'll be facing in 20 years. Just like pollution. You know, a lot of countries don't have to worry about pollution. They see America or Japan, they say, oh, wow, what a mess. But it'll happen there, too. Yeah.
It was sort of a digression, but you know, what you were saying.